Fourth Industrial Revolution. Heard of it? Maybe not, but I guarantee you're living in it, right at this very moment. I am Suzanne Lang, bringing you a novel idea. Technology and artificial intelligence, genomics and blockchains infiltrate our banking and economic systems, transportation, our education, healthcare, communication, and every aspect of our lives. Who is managing all this and who is safeguarding us from harm and exploitation? There is a rising movement of economists and academics, clerics and technology innovators who seek a code of ethics to guide how we live with this fourth industrial revolution, which is the revolution of technology. And this code is a transhuman code. Today's show is truly about humanity. In our first segment, we'll talk with David Ferguson, who, along with Carlos Moreira, authored The Transhuman Code, How to Program Your Future. The book raises questions and is a guide for us to understand how we must embed humanity in our technology rather than the other way around. Later, we'll visit with Paula Gianturco, whose colorful book of stories and photographs is about the humanity that we must bring to each other. Her book is Grandmother Power, A Global Phenomenon. It's a novel idea. David Ferguson is a corporate finance leader and pioneer in cross-border investment. He is recognized as an expert on the impact of technology on business, government, and humankind. Carlos Moreira is a technology pioneer in online security and trust management and the founder of one of the world's first cybersecurity companies, WiseKey. Together, they have written The Transhuman Code, How to Program Your Future, just one piece in a global movement that seeks to manage the convergence of humanity and technology and ensure that humanity prevails. I spoke with David from his home in New York. Let's listen to our conversation. David Ferguson, your book, The Transhuman Code, How to Program Your Future, that you co-wrote with Carlos Moreira. Welcome to have a conversation with us today about this important topic.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here with you.
The Transhuman Code, I think there's so much to unpack here, and I'd like you to give our readers and listeners a definition of the Transhuman Code and maybe talk a little bit about the Fourth Industrial Revolution and how this pertains to us today and moving into our future.
Yeah, it would be my pleasure. And I think perhaps the best place to begin to answer that question is to tell you why we're doing it. Both Carlos Moreira and I are not authors, and both of us agree that the last thing the world needs is another book about technology. But we do believe that it's important that we share with you the experiences that we have and that we continue to create with those individuals and organizations that are impacting how technology is going to influence our lives going forward. Carlos is one of the veteran pioneers in cybersecurity. He founded WiseKey 20 years ago in Geneva, Switzerland. He was a very important member of the security team at the UN. And he was very close to Tim Berners-Lee, who you would know has just celebrated his 30th anniversary of having created the World Wide Web. And it was at Davos, which is a gathering of business, political, religious, philanthropic leaders that occurs in a sleepy little ski town in the Swiss Alps each January. And it was there 4 years ago that Carlos and I and Tim Berners-Lee found ourselves in a quite a dynamic discussion around the need to create a trust protocol, anticipating, in fact, some of the things that have materialized through the past 12 months were going to occur. And specifically, the technology that's been programmed for us and that has enhanced our life so dramatically for our shopping and socializing and searching has access to data. Of course, we know that when we participate with these platforms, but we weren't aware, at least the general public wasn't aware of how that data was being used, how it could be used legally, and how potentially it could be abused. So that was the catalyst for Carlos and I to begin a dialogue with academics, technology developers, political leaders, and influencers around the need for us to recognize and take control of ensuring that we always put people first. And so the Transhuman Code began as a roundtable session at the World Economic Forum. And we began to write in collaboration with many wise women and men. And very proudly, we previewed the book at the World Economic Forum in January of this year. And it launched in June globally.
The book is as you're describing it, part of a movement. Part of a movement,
yes,
of how we can move forward in this age of rapidly expanding technology, infiltrating our lives and environment, and trying to bring some morality to it. Would that be a way to say it?
Yeah, no, I think I think that's a perfect way to say it. We're all quite enamored, aren't we, with the technological wonders that allow us to do so many more things today than we could do a year ago, 5 years ago, 10 years ago. But with that, those technologies comes both change that is desired, change that is not desired, and potentially a risk to the livelihood that we all enjoy. You know, we don't have a global governor of technology. There isn't a person that decides what technology is developed, where and when it's implemented, and at what cost and or for what benefit the users. So that means that really all of us, the developers of technology, the enablers of technology, I'm an investment banker, as you know, and so an important part of my work is ensuring that technology companies have the funding that they need to continue to grow. And of course, all of us as users of technology, collectively, we need to become the programmers. We've seen what happens when those platforms that we use for searching and shopping and socializing, when they use our data irresponsibly. So we've been witness to that, and that activity is going to continue. I'm not particularly worried that we won't figure out how to regulate the use of our data, and that we won't figure out how to protect our digital engagement. What I'm most worried about is that we won't make the right decisions in terms of our future of work, our future of education, our future of governance. Those are areas that I think require very, very close attention. And first and foremost, we really wanted this book to be a fire starter. We wanted to engage and initiate a dialogue with people of all ages about how they can ensure that the technology that they have access to, the technology that they may be enabling, the technology that they may be contributing to the development of, that it's used for the best of all humanity. There has never been a better time for us to be able to equalize socially those individuals that live across the world. I've just returned from Uganda, where I've had the opportunity to participate and work together with the two largest banks in the country, and I think one of the most dynamic accelerators and incubators that I've seen anywhere in the world And they've committed that for any organization that's going to be receive any financial support, any consultative support from them going forward, that they're going to have to demonstrate that in addition to their commercial business activities, that there will be a social good initiative that is derived from their technology. It's a small start, but that's exactly the mindset that I think we need to be adopting.
Some of your book, and I should mention that the book does pose a lot of questions. You organize the book kind of somewhat thematically for the first half and ask us, the readers, to reflect on certain things. And then you highlight some conversations with a lot of noted thinkers on this subject. But as I was reading the book, there were times when I had kind of a knot in my stomach about the potential for doing the exact opposite of what you're describing, with regard to healthcare, with regard to human employment. Often it's the least educated, the least talented people in our society who are doing a lot of labor, manufacturing, delivery, and that they would maybe be the first ones affected by some further deeper mechanization. And also, I should say, we have a global population problem on the planet. Yet you describe that this does not, advancing technology doesn't have to marginalize people, and if we're thoughtful about it. And that, in fact, it could free many of us from labor, of working all the time and just trying to hold on in our global economy. So can you address this a little bit and break that down for me about how you see that people don't have to be marginalized?
Well, again, what you've just shared with me is one of the challenges that we encountered very early on in thinking about how to assemble information and how to share it most effectively so that people could become aware. And that really is really the guiding principle in this whole process. John Redinger, John is the founder of Techno Buffalo, which is one of the largest reviewers, I think, in the world today of technology products, said it very well when I spoke with him about 18 months ago in the early stages of this project. And, you know, he said, you know, David, you know, every user of technology, which is pretty much everybody, has to be a part of this dialogue. You know, his quote, his formal quote was, you know, before anybody picks up their telephone again, they should be reading the transhuman code. My message is, you know, before you pick up your telephone again, you know, just understand what it does and understand what it can do positively and negatively. There are organizations and institutions that can play a pivotal role in helping all of us just understand what the implications of technology are. I am a firm believer in the value of empowering people to do more. And I have a particular interest in the developing markets. I've been active in China for for decades now, and over the last decade, becoming increasingly active in the African continent and Latin America. And I'm really encouraged by how technology is empowering individuals to think beyond what they have presently. And so that's the good. The bad is that technology can be used to manipulate situations. But in the middle of all of this is the need to understand what the future can be. And so through the book, we were inspired by Maslow's hierarchy of needs. And whilst we don't put ourselves on that same pedestal by any means, we thought it would be interesting to look at the evolution of technology and its application to our life ecosystem. And so In the book, we talk about the future of water. We talk about the future of finance. We talk about the future of communication and transportation. We talk about employment and education, and we go deep enough to be able to share those developments that are presently in front of us, that the experiences are being witnessed. But you're right. We ask between 5 and 10 questions before we let you out of that chapter about how will technology continue to influence your education and or your employment. Because being aware of the dramatic change, and I can tell you that having been working specifically on this initiative for 4 years now, that the pace is actually faster than what we had anticipated. The numbers that are quoted each year when we gather at Davos forecasting the impact of technology, we seem to exceed at an increasingly faster pace. So when we look at the future of employment, I believe the most recent statistics, which were published in November, which suggested that 125 million jobs will be created from artificial intelligence and robotics. This is very positive. What is more challenging, of course, is that 75 million people will be displaced. Now, some of them will be reskilled, will choose to focus, will be chosen to become part of the next workforce. But even then, we still have, if it was 100% of those 75, we still have a 50 million person gap. So how are we going to deal with that? Well, I can tell you that on average in North America today, it takes 2.7 years to introduce a new course into a high school or university curriculum. And that's not fast enough for us to be able to catch up. Now, some of our Fortune 500 companies, and I would tell you that there's much more attention being focused here on the West Coast than there is on the East, not surprising. In the Northern California market, there's a much higher level of awareness of the impact of technology. And so we are seeing some reskilling initiatives being developed with inside corporations. I'm concerned that it's not even part of the dialogue in small and medium-sized companies. And I'm particularly concerned about the developing markets and how they're going to advance themselves, although they may be able to move quicker through their educational institutions. They may have less burden for the pace of change that we experience here. However, there's a much, much smaller participation rate in the developing countries or secondary and post-secondary education. So that in and of itself, I think, presents us with a global problem.
I was talking to our producer before we called you and describing the themes in your book, and I said, we're on this edge between a utopian future and a dystopian future, because yes, it's easy to see both scenarios. You, in the book, present this notion of healthcare that could be literally customized for the individual and based on genomics or being able to really see into the our own DNA even, and how that could transform human living, and that over time maybe we would see that we have a stable, healthy population, and that we would see the populations plateau or maybe even start diminishing on the planet. Because I see some of our real challenges that technology can help us crack or just blow over. You know, when we think about technology being involved in an individual's life from really the moment of birth, and that we have currently apparatus. We have phones, tablets, computers, wires, electricity that all seem to require some sort of resource extraction and waste generation. And it's hard for me to get beyond that it's not only the social and cultural that we need to approach thoughtfully, but, you know, we're creating almost a virtual reality because we're expending our actual reality. So and I guess I just wonder what some of your thoughts are on that, especially if you're doing a lot of work in parts of the world that this resource extraction is happening in.
Well, this really comes back to the fact that there isn't a central body. There certainly isn't an individual, and there isn't a central body that's responsible for determining what should or shouldn't be done. So the establishment of ethics for the programming of our future really stands at the forefront. One of the items that came out of our dialogue, our collective dialogue beginning 3 years ago, was the importance of having a manifesto. Mm-hmm. And whilst we're not suggesting that the citizens of the world should sign it, but we'd like the citizens of the world to be aware of those elements of which it's comprised. And you know, the right to privacy, the right to consent, the right to manage your own identity. Those things are very much a part of the popular dialogue today. And as the investigations continue, we will become increasingly aware of just what we're doing, what our digital footprint is, and how it can be managed. And again, I'm not as concerned about that. I believe that we have systems all over the world that will allow us to manage that effectively. But agreeing on a set of ethics, so what should we do? What should we allow health technology to accomplish? How should we allow technology to affect livelihood through employment? Who should make those decisions? I'm not sure if you are aware, but I've just returned from the Vatican, where I was asked to come together with a group of religious leaders, those who are advising the Pope on his perspective on the convergence of technology and humanity. Recently, a NGO, a not-for-profit organization, was created called Humanity 2.0, and they were created expressly for this purpose. And Pope Francis's position is that technology becomes socially dangerous if the human becomes a product of technology instead of technology becoming more humane. And that has been, you know, widely publicized. But what I really appreciate from his perspective is that, you know, he shares in the amazement of technology for the growth of scientific innovation. But if I can quote him, he says, you know, how wonderful would it be, you know, while we're developing these dynamic new technologies, we're discovering faraway planets, you know, we're curing the ills that plague us. How wouldn't it be incredible if we could also rediscover and support the needs of the brothers and sisters that are orbiting around us? And I think that this is, regardless of one's religious affiliation, I think this is at the root of that ethical message is, Let's prioritize using technology for good first. Let's make sure that we're putting people first.
You know, David, it's interesting. I was visiting a friend yesterday and picked up a magazine on their coffee table, which was the Jesuit Review of Faith and Culture, a magazine I'd never seen before. But in it, what got my attention, there's this article called The Blockchain Church. Can the technology behind Bitcoin be used to build a belief system? And just because I had been reading your book and it got my attention, that what you're talking about seems that maybe we need to move towards new social systems, religious systems, and more collaborative systems on a global basis, because you earlier said, well, we don't have a global governor of technology. Well, we really don't have a global governor of anything. And maybe in feudal times, that's what fighting was all about, trying to gain that kind of domination. But it seems that right now we're at a point where we might be involved in resistance to that. I mean, in our own country, certainly throughout Europe, as it's portrayed in the media, at least, we have, nationalism growing. And yet it seems like that's something, maybe that's a, it's in its dying throes, because intrinsically, as human creatures, maybe we know we need each other and need to collaborate to transform our world. I don't know. And you're just talking about being at the Vatican. It seems like technology and faith are maybe more intertwined than we think.
Yeah, you know, what's interesting is that I learned this through our working sessions on Monday, that in fact, you know, well before the first Industrial Revolution, and you referenced earlier that in fact we are indeed in what's been coined as the fourth Industrial Revolution, the digital revolution. During the 13th century, monasteries and the Vatican were actually incubators of engineering technology. There are in fact four saints for the engineering occupation. So the Catholic Church was, in fact, we could say, you know, that it was the Silicon Valley of the Middle Ages. The Catholic Church is particularly interested in how they can use technology to communicate most effectively amongst their following. And they're particularly interested in how they might be able to impact some of the ethical decisions that need to be made. And I can tell you, we did not originally involve religious leaders. We didn't exclude them, and there certainly were contributors, but we did not go out in search of their perspective on this. Certainly my takeaway from that day, and we brought finance leaders, corporate leaders, academic leaders together to be a part of that dialogue, and we certainly found an abundance of wisdom. And I think potentially an institution that has the ability to affect more goods being done. They're certainly embracing artificial intelligence. Father Philip Larrey, who is one of the papal advisors on technology, has published his second book on the subject of artificial humanity. And I certainly left very encouraged that there will be collaboration in definition of principles that will guide us and communication of those principles. So I'm an optimistic pessimist by nature. I believe that everything's possible, but there's certainly lots of obstacles. And I pride myself on trying to look forward to where those obstacles are and when they will appear. But I'm certainly quite encouraged by the interest, not only that the book has garnered, but also from the contributions that we've been able to experience since then. And we're preparing now for what will kick off mid-fall to be a series of what we call the Transhuman Code Meeting of the Minds sessions, and these will be town hall sessions held together with leading academic institutions around the world, INSEAD, MIT, Cambridge, University of Guelph, just to name a few. Tsinghua University in Beijing. And here we'll be bringing together students, academics, and members of the supporting community to have this conversation. I'm honored that the church wants to be a part of this, and that we'll be the beneficiaries of their contribution.
And what can you recommend for our readers and listeners who may pick up this book and not have the experience of going to Davos, but here in Sonoma County or elsewhere, what can individuals do to explore and collaborate on this kind of movement?
Well, you know, the very reason that we've written this book is because a very small number of people are able to go or choose to go to be a part of the World Economic Forum and have access to these individuals and organizations that are so dramatically influencing change. And in fact, it was coming out of our preview at Davos that we made the decision to include several of the conversations, what we refer to as conversations with the innovators, in the final edition of the book that came out last month. The most important thing is to be inquisitive. So know that dramatic change is upon us. And I just can't stress that enough. So know that it's happening. Engage in it. So take an interest. Be aware of how those elements of your life ecosystem are going to be changing. Engage with those that you think can have the greatest impact for you. It may be, and I can tell you as the proud father with my wife of two 16-year-olds who will be entering college in 2 years' time, I've been particularly interested about the future of education. And I'm encouraging them to curate their own education, to accept what is made available to them from the institutions that they attend, but be aware that their future will not look like it does today, that there will be many choices, that they will have the option and or the requirement to continue to transform themselves for the future of work. And so that's an area that's of particular interest to me. The future of communication may be of interest to another. I think we're all interested in the future of employment. We're all interested in the future of how we're going to be governed. But engage and activate. Just put yourself in it. Begin to explore and begin to apply what you're learning to how your life is going to be in the future. I don't want to ever want to appear to be alarmist, but the pace of change and the people in not only in the developed countries, but in the developing countries that we are empowering to create new technological innovations and applications for us, it just gets faster every day.
Yes, I was recently at a conference where I was surprised at how technology was being used to save elephants in a wildlife refuge from poaching. Yeah. And certainly in Africa, there is real changing economies there, and that are graphic. In our own country, I think to many of us, it's almost invisible when it shouldn't be, because we see how it is affecting us on very overt planes, like our elections, like, you know, these mass shootings that have been taking place are somewhat enabled by technology. And I think sometimes we don't really hear, and we are not a third world country, but we take a lot for granted and might be the ones who are caught by surprise by some of this. I lastly wanted to ask you if you are, or your writing partner, Carlos, Are either one of you surfers? You have kind of an impassioned a case study of surfing as one of the purest microcosms of humanity's relationship with today's innovation. So just can you give us a little bit on that?
I wish I was a surfer. I'm a windsurfer. I've grown up as a sailor. I come from the east coast of Canada, but I do think that the surfing experience I think is particularly germane to for what lies in front of us now. You're the first one to ask me that question.
Well, I found it kind of interesting. You do use a lot of very relatable examples in your book, from automated services of my refrigerator knowing when I need milk or yogurt, and the store having it delivered all kind of with my consent, but I don't have to do anything other than that. And I thought that the surfing example brought it also to terms of that were maybe lower tech, but showed a stream of innovation and where it can go. So I don't know. I appreciated it.
I'm glad. Most importantly, what we've tried to do is to make the subject matter accessible to everyone, because it really does affect us all.
It certainly does.
And there are so many wonderfully wise people that are acting and inspiring others to act in the areas of technology development and application. There's so much out there, but it really is important for us to recognize that that change is not just coming, it's here, and it's heavy and it's fast.
I'm talking with David Ferguson and with his writing partner, Carlos Moreira, have released The Transhuman Code, How to Program Your Future. And I thank you for joining us today, David, and wonder if there's anything you'd like to leave us with.
Well, that's it. Thank you. It's truly been a pleasure, and I learned so much myself through each interaction that I've experienced with this project, and so I do appreciate your questions. You know, what became a core pillar of this program early on, but it's certainly has been reinforced through the literally thousands of conversations we've had about the subject. And that is that whilst dynamic new technologies are being developed every minute of every day, truly the greatest technology of all is us. It's the human being. And that if we will embrace that, then we can apply that to everything that we do, and that will ensure that the human being stays at the center of gravity in this relationship with technology, and that humanity as a whole will benefit.
Thank you so much, David. I think that's a great way to wrap up our conversation, and I've appreciated talking to you too.
Thank you.
David Ferguson, who along with Carlos Moreira authored The Transhuman Code, How to Program Your Future. I am Suzanne Lang with a novel idea. Paula Jeanturco is a photojournalist whose work focuses on women around the world who break through barriers and overcome difficult situations, socially and culturally. Jeanturco emerged from a career in marketing and corporate communications and began documenting women's lives after attending the UN's Fourth World Conference on Women in Beijing. She has traveled around the world documenting women's stories, has published 6 books, and I spoke to her upon the release of Grandmother Power, a global phenomenon. Here is our conversation. Paula Gianturco, welcome to Sonoma County.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
Today, we're going to talk about and explore your book, Grandmother Power, a Global Phenomenon. It's filled with colorful pictures that I believe you've taken.
I did take them.
And wonderful stories of tens of women in oral histories and your own narrative that fills us in as readers on history and culture from all over the planet. And I want to start by quoting here from your book, and it's on the 13 indigenous grandmothers. When your stone rolls along a certain length of time, you gather things with it. If you've been awake while traveling, even better. If you put that into spiritual focus, how potent it becomes. And when I read that line, I thought it really epitomized everything that you're pulling together in this book about women, grandmothers. Certainly you do talk about men in the book, but grandmothers around the planet, women around the planet who have lived life and are continuing to live life and remind us and remind people and remind children what we need to do to be good and right and safe and healthy and take care of each other.
It's a wonderful quote. I'm so glad you picked that one. It's actually something that was said by a woman who lives not too far from here. Her name is Jyoti. And she lives in the Russian River area. She convened the International Council of 13 Indigenous Grandmothers, and she's sent invitations through her spiritual network to shamans and healers all over the world and invited some 16 who could make particular contributions, she believed, to this council. There is a shared prophecy among indigenous people around the world, people as far-flung as Gabon and Brazil and Alaska. And that prophecy suggested that there would be a time when the grandmothers convened to awaken the world. And when they gathered in New York, not New York City, out at the Dalai Lama's retreat center, they discovered that there were 13. One of those grandmothers, whose name is Rita Blumenstein, had been given by her mother when she was a child 13 feathers and 13 stones with the instructions to distribute them among the 13 grandmothers whom she knew her daughter would meet sometime later in her life. So it was clear that this was a council that was founded to fulfill that prophecy. And those women, full of indigenous wisdom, which they agreed to share because the world was in such terrible condition, that they believed that the wisdom of their ancestors could help steer through a future that was opaque, that was very difficult to navigate. So every 6 months, they have a gathering on one of their indigenous lands. Last year, they were in Nepal. So each year, it's in a different place. I photographed them when they were in meeting in Sedona.
And I thought this was a good way to start because it is all about women coming together in groups to build upon their experience and strengthen one another and then radiate out into the community in a forcefulness that maybe they don't have individually.
Oh, I'm sure. Radiate out into the community is a wonderful way to express it. In fact, these groups of grandmothers, which are convened because they look around at our troubled world and say, whew, not good enough for my beloved grandchildren. So they gather in groups and get to work, tackling the issues that are most important in their communities. And that brings them to very different issues. But they call on their strength and their ability to help each other move forward. And they are, in fact, very strong. Do not underestimate these grandmothers. They bring not only their wisdom, but their energy. You know, grandmothers today are younger than grandmothers have ever been. So they bring energy. Many of them in the Northern Hemisphere have had careers, so it makes them effective. All over the world, grandmothers are living longer and starting to be grandmothers younger. You know, we have such a good healthcare system now, at least in the global north, that grandmothers can be energetic, relatively young, pretty well educated, effective, and because the boomers are now becoming grandmothers, they came of age in the 60s. They know they can change the world because they did.
And in your book, which is structured in such a way that it's not exactly geographical, the chapters are more thematic, and I was struck by the range of issues going from AIDS, HIV in Africa, to politics in America, to the Lolas in the Philippines, women who had been forced to be comfort women by the Japanese during World War II. Do you want to talk a little bit about them, maybe? That was a surprising bit of history that you articulate so clearly.
The Japanese government, through its military, abducted women all over Asia, wherever they had troops. And they kidnapped, essentially, and held prisoner a young adolescent girl for each of 100 soldiers in our army. Those young girls were forced to service perhaps 10 men a night. And that could go on for months and months and months. The Philippines had some 30 garrisons that doubled as brothels during the war. So there were a number of Philippine women who were so ashamed of having been forced to be sex slaves, essentially, that they didn't tell their own husbands or their own children for years and years and years. And similarly, there was radio silence in Korea, where there was an even larger number of women. There were also comfort women in Japan. No one talked about this. It was considered enormously shameful. Much to everyone's surprise, in the Philippines, in the early 90s, a woman named Rosa Henson went on television in Manila and told her story, and invited the other Lolas, the other comfort women, to come and fight with her for their rights. And slowly but surely, they gathered the courage to do that, some of them telling their stories for the first time on the radio and on television at the same time their children were learning of these terrible experiences. They banded together into groups with chapters throughout the Philippines. I interviewed the women who were part of the chapter in Manila, who are now in their 80s and 90s. They have not stopped fighting. In the late 90s, they brought a class action suit against the government of Japan, and they asked for reparations and a formal apology and a place in the history books so that subsequent generations would know about this and it wouldn't happen again. After some 10 years of making its way through the courts, that case was rejected by the Japanese Supreme Court, even though the women in the Philippines, working in concert with comfort women in the other parts of Asia who also brought similar suits, even though they lost, they have continued to fight. And as I interviewed them, they said to me, you know, my mother lived to be 96. I will use the rest of my years to fight on. They are so determined to quell this kind of sexual violence against women and girls everywhere, that they are now building international support to stand against these issues. And they march in the streets, never mind that many of them are using walkers. They collect signatures on petitions. They speak at universities. They are formidable.
It's difficult sometimes to, in reading people's stories and what they're responding to acknowledge that there is so much abuse, so much violation, so much violence against people, against women, against children. Yet there are these women who are fighting, not afraid of the military. They might be afraid or apprehensive, but embody a power that I see as uniquely female, standing against often tyranny and subjugation.
Certainly that was the case in the Philippines, and that kind of power is the reason for the title of the book, Grandmother Power, indeed. Sometimes it takes many years to acknowledge that kind of power. But a great motivator is to know that the world is just plain not good enough for your grandchildren, and you don't have lots and lots and lots of time to make it better.
I was struck by some of the stories coming out of the women in Israel. And I'd like you to talk about that a little bit, what that experience was like for you to be with them.
Well, I'll tell you quickly the story about the grandmothers in Israel who are doing something that surprises many people. Every day, 70 to 100,000 Palestinians go through the military checkpoints to get to jobs and works and doctored work and doctor's appointments to schools and so forth. And it is a strategy of the Israel Defense Forces to hold them at the checkpoints. I suppose I don't know of a military organization in the world that is not taught to maintain power and control. And the idea of the delay at the checkpoints is a way to maintain control. But the delays were extensive. I mean, 6 hours and 8 hours. Women gave birth at the checkpoints. Babies died at the checkpoints. Palestinians were not allowed to have medical access. People died at the checkpoints. And the Jewish Israeli grandmothers felt that that way of dealing with the Palestinians was completely unacceptable. So four hundred of them, organized into a group called Maxim Watch. Maxim Watch means checkpoint watch. And these grandmothers, two by two, have gone to monitor their own soldiers at the checkpoints throughout the West Bank every single day since 2002, the Second Intifada. And they issue reports to the journalists, they issue reports on the internet, and they issue reports to the Knesset when there is abuse, which unfortunately is an ongoing problem. But they have managed to gain some surprising, I must say, reluctant support, even from the IDF, whose spokesman recently said, "We've learned that there are things that can be done better." So some, not all checkpoints now, have shade. Some of them have bathrooms. Some of them have humanitarian assistance hotlines. Some of them, again, not all, have places where Muslims can spread their prayer rugs if they are in the checkpoints when it's time to pray. So there are some improvements. The grandmothers are not satisfied. They say, "We are not the social workers of the checkpoints," one woman said to me. But they at least have been able to make some progress. And this is an unbelievably controversial kind of behavior for them to be doing. Soldiers in their own families don't support it. It has caused real rifts between them and the people whom they love most. And yet they have just won the highest award that is given by the Association for Civil Rights in Israel.
I'm talking with Paola Gianturco about her book, Grandmother Power, A Global Phenomenon, which is not only a book with lots of stories of courage and innovation, but it's got some fabulous pictures in it, too, of colorful, smiling women laughing, hugging. And I wonder if you could talk about your own process as a photographer. Here you're interviewing people, often with a translator, and taking pictures as well. So how is that for you?
I always do the interviews first. Because I find if you've talked to someone for an hour, you begin to have a sense of who they are and how you might represent them in a photograph. And to do that any earlier feels really invasive to me. So I wait until we have established some rapport. I work very hard to avoid a sense of the Spanish Inquisition. I sometimes show pictures of my own grandchildren and they show me pictures of theirs. And I always end the interviews by inviting them to ask me questions because reciprocity seems to me to be fair. But I don't take pictures too soon. All of them have agreed to be part of this project by the time I am talking with them. I always start by showing them my other books, which look quite like this. That gives them a sense of what they're really getting into. Even if they're not literate, they can see what it means to be part of a book like this. And they're very interested in women in other places. So often that's a very engaging beginning point of departure. I feel much more comfortable doing this than I did when I started the first book. This is book number 5. I remember going to Poland and Turkey, which was sort of a test run for me, thinking, why would anyone talk to me? First of all, everybody in the world, particularly in what had been Eastern Bloc countries and in the developing world, assumes that people in the United States are all rich. Second of all, I am well educated, and many of them haven't been even to the second grade, if at all. So it was hard for me to imagine why they would talk to me openly. And what I discovered immediately was that I was talking with women whom people don't listen to and who aren't heard. The fact that I had come so far to do nothing but listen to them opened up windows that I would never have imagined. They told me things I would never have asked. And they were very open and very comfortable. I was honored by that.
Well, I'm honored to have you in the studio today, and I want to thank you and encourage our readers to pick up a copy of this lovely book and share it with a mother, a grandmother, or a grandother. Thank you.
Thank you.
Paola Gianturco, Grandmother Power. Earlier, I spoke with David Ferguson on the Transhuman Code, How to Program Your Future. Both Paola and David remind us of our responsibilities as global citizens and the challenge of asserting dignity and respect into our economic, political, and technological institutions. I thank you for listening. Visit norcalpublicmedia.org and subscribe to our podcasts. I have had production assistance from Anthony Garcia, Sean Knight, and Mark Prell. I am Suzanne Lang with a novel idea.